Okay, folks, today we have a special guest. We're talking with Wildman Steve Brill from New York. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. And I think a lot of the listeners know of you because you were the famous wild man who was in the news picking the weeds in Central Park in New York. And I bet that was quite an experience. I mean, it did give you national exposure for doing what you do. So ultimately, it was a good thing, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Very few things happened to me that were better than being put in handcuffs by undercover agents for eating a dandelion in Central Park.
You know, I even remember cartoons that were drawn about you with your bush hat and being arrested for picking weeds. But that is kind of ironic, isn't it? It's come to the point where you cannot go into the wild areas legally and just pick things that everybody else regards as a nuisance.
Yeah, well, the Parks Commissioner told me the real story behind that, and that's the current Parks Commissioner, Adrian Denefee, who recently put out some very misleading anti-foraging propaganda. What he told me to
anti-foraging propaganda, okay.
What he told me to my face was that the Parks officials are deathly afraid of frivolous lawsuits. If they officially allow foraging, they think that someone is going to say, we foraged, we poisoned ourselves, you allowed foraging, and we are going to sue the pants off the city.
I suppose there's some legitimacy to that because we live in a sue-happy country. You know what I tell people?
Well, I worked for them for 4 years. I led hundreds of tours as a parks naturalist, and I've been doing this total now of 30 years, and no one has sued me, and no one sued the Parks Department while I was there. So there is the little matter of reality that sometimes gets in the way of these phobias.
Right, right. Well, you know, I get people asking me all the time also about poisonous plants. Occasionally a student will say, I need to know all of the poisonous plants. And I say, no, you don't. All you need to know is what you're eating.
Well, they might be having the boss over for dinner.
Oh, maybe so, huh? So, Steve, I don't know if everybody knows your whole story, but I thought we'd talk about how you got into this in the first place, and we could talk about some of your books and things of that sort. So at what age did you realize you were really turned on to nature and wild foods?
That would be in my early 30s. Before that, I was trying to become a chess master, and I'm a Class A-rated tournament player, although I haven't played in tournaments for years, play against my iPad, and I can still give it a good beating once in a while. So I discovered I was never going to become a chess master.
I didn't know that about you.
Like you're a good ball player, but not good enough to play in the minor leagues.
Right.
So I had to eat to survive, and I went into the kitchen. There was a carton of oatmeal, and there was a cookie recipe on the back, which I made. It was really the first time I did a recipe or took an interest in cooking in my life, and it tasted good enough that I graduated to the raisin box and eventually found my way into the public library and got more and more interested in gourmet cooking, particularly using whole healthful ingredients. I became a vegan in 1990. I don't use refined ingredients and have come up with an entire cuisine where you can basically have your cake and eat it because the cakes and everything else and even the mock meat dishes are made with alternative ingredients that you get in the health store and in the wild that are incredible tasting and have wonderful potential. So I started on this path. I was exploring ethnic stores in Queens and New York City where I live that had lots of various ethnic populations. And one day I was bicycling past a park, it was called Cunningham Park, and there were these ethnic Greek women, traditional, dressed in black, picking something in the park. And because I had already been interested in food, I stopped and asked them what they were collecting. It was all Greek to me.
Okay.
And a word. But they were able to convey that they were picking grape leaves, and I came home with a bag of them. Very generous.
They were picking wild grape leaves or what?
Wild grape leaves, yes.
Wow.
And I made my own stuffed grape leaf recipe. It was wonderful. I started getting what field guides were around. And as I'm sure you know, a lot of these books were written by botanists who wouldn't know what a kitchen was if one fell on their heads, didn't forage personally, and relied mainly on third-hand information, which made things very inaccurate. But over a number of years, I was able to slowly accumulate knowledge of wild plants, which I'm still doing to this day. And just 2 years ago, I found that something I'm sure you're familiar with, the toothache tree.
What's another name for the toothache tree?
Well, it's also called Hercules club, and I forgot the scientific name.
Actually, Steve, I don't know that tree.
Okay, I might not grow in your area, but it's synonymous with prickly. The prickly ash is synonymous with Sichuan pepper.
Oh, okay.
I passed that by for many, many decades before my lawyer, of all people, who happens to be a foodie, which is why she was on one of my tours.
I'm losing you a little bit.
Alerted me to the identity, and of course I started using it, and it's wonderful. So that's just a recent one.
Uh-huh. Steve, and what were some of the early
scientific name is Xanthoxylum americanum.
Okay, we could all look that up then. Say that one more time.
Xanthoxylum, Xanthoxylum americanum, American with a U-M at
okay.
the end.
I'll look it up in the flora books for my area. What were some of the references that you first used when you started studying ethnobotany and wild foods?
At that time, there was just Ewell Gibbons' books and a Peterson Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants, a Newcomb's Wildflower Guide, and a very user-unfriendly Peterson's Field Guide to Trees and Shrubs.
Yeah.
This was before Gary Linkoff's Audubon Mushroom Guide came out, so I had Orson Miller's Mushrooms of North America, and various things. I think there was a foraging book by Jim Hall.
Alan Hall,
yeah. Whose son I actually taught in a day camp back in the 80s. So that was really all I had, but I have been relentlessly experimenting in the kitchen to actually find out what the culinary properties of these plants are. Again, using my experience with trying to use natural ingredients and looking at traditions from India, from Thailand, from France, from the Caribbean, and coming up with schemes of using the oils and the herbs with alternative ingredients to make everything from dandelion colombo to curried sunflower seeds.
And you have a lot of those recipes in what book?
The Wild Vegan Cookbook that has 500 of my best recipes.
Those are 500 original recipes?
Yeah.
Wow.
Sometime this spring, my Wild Vegan Recipe app will become available. And in addition to identifying and harvesting edible and medicinal plants in wild and not so wild places, which covers edibles and their medicinal properties and recipes from the whole country, I also have shoots and greens of early spring, which covers the first plants that come up in the Northeast. Probably half of those curly dock sheep sorrel chickweed grow across the country. And I have an app called Wild Edibles you can download from the iTunes Store or the Android Marketplace. That's my most recent. And that has everything I know about all the edible plants in my region. Again, half of which will be growing where you are very similar plants, which I do refer to. And I go over the black walnut in great detail, and you probably have the California walnut somewhere in your area.
We have a black walnut out here. It's not the same one that you have, but, yeah, walnuts are pretty ubiquitous.
Yes, juggling. You've seen one, you see them all.
Right, right. They're pretty easy to recognize. You know, I used Ewell Gibbons' books, too. And they weren't the best for identification in some cases.
Exactly.
But he did do a lot of kitchen experimenting. He had a lot of original research. One of the ones that I fondly remember when I lived in Ohio, believe it or not, in Chardon. And if you know Chardon, this week we had the high school shooting in Chardon. I lived in Chardon in the mid-70s at my grandfather's farm. And we used to see daylilies everywhere. I learned about daylilies from Yul Gibbons.
I love those.
Yeah, but you know what I learned? You know what I did not learn from Yul Gibbons? He didn't say, don't eat the roots raw. He even suggested you could eat them raw.
Well, I think more people get sick from the roots than any other part of the plant. Daylily is one of those plants that most people can eat, and some people get pretty severe gastrointestinal symptoms from them.
Yeah, I kind of read that in passing once, that severe gastrointestinal sickness, and actually there was the phrase, may disagree with some people. What that meant to my brother and I was at 2 a.m. where we were vomiting violently from the daylily, the raw tubers. But they are delicious, cooked.
Yeah, not everyone will get sick from the raw tubers. So if people find the compulsion to be daring, and there's so many safer things to fool around with, you just take a little bite, and then maybe two bites the next day and three bites the third to see whether you the plant disagrees with you. There are also some daylilies, genetic strains you cannot distinguish from others, that will get everyone violently sick, any part of the plant. I forget the name of the foraging teacher, but I think she was somewhere in the Midwest, and she and her group ate daylilies, and every single one of them got violently sick from them. It's the only time I've ever heard of this.
Was that even when cooked, Steve?
Yes, even when cooked.
Oh, wow.
Any part of daylilies from one particular stand, which you couldn't distinguish from the others, got everyone sick. So there are obviously genetic differences between one daylily stand and the other.
So there might be rules of thumb, but there are always exceptions, it seems, too. Like, generally, I think of daylilies as a very safe group.
Yeah, no one who hasn't followed the rule of eating very small amounts the first time, because there's some people that'll throw up from the leaves, from the shoots as well, has gotten in trouble with those in my area. And
yeah.
I lead hundreds of tours every year.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, as we're recording this, the last day of February, I'm about to start on my 30th season of foraging tours.
That's fantastic. Give us your website for people who want to see what you got going.
Okay, the website is wildmansteve.brill, BRILL.com. I've got lots of plants there, TV clips, press clips, info about what I do with schools, day camps, garden clubs, museums, and libraries. It's a fun site. I try to put everything interesting on there. I'm also on Facebook. You can send me a friend request and certainly follow me on Twitter.
Now, Steve, it's winter. I think we've all had a mild winter, but let's say there's snow on the ground in your region, New York.
Yeah, there isn't. We've had dandelions right through the winter. The first time I've ever seen dandelion greens that have not disappeared. All the cold weather plants have just kept going and going and going. Curly dock never disappeared. Chickweed never disappeared. Quite an amazingly mild period.
But let me ask you, what if there is snow on the ground? What do you do on walks? Do you look at the bare trees? And I mean, there's nature observation you could do year round. What would you do in the wintertime?
Well, that's when I write my books.
Okay.
There are certainly things to find. If there is no snow, you can get garlic, mustard, field garlic, and chickweed in the winter, and certainly sassafras and black birch are around, and you can look at winter forms and identify the skeletons of pokeweed and the like, but the books and the app do not suddenly spring into existence on their own.
Right.
So I sort of hold up. The the other thing is that people don't seem to want to sign up for these tours in the winter.
Oh, that's a good
point.
Very
large turnout spring, summer, and fall, but not really in the winter, so I lay low.
Right, I understand that. Tell us some of the things that you're seeing in New York, some of the common greens. I'll let you know if they're out here too.
Okay, well, you certainly have dandelion greens and one other thing about the winter.
Yeah.
This is one of the most interesting things I've come across last year, and I'd like your take on it. Where exactly are you located?
Well, I grew up in the Pasadena area. I lived for the last 25 or so years in Los Angeles, which is northeast L.A., which borders on Pasadena. So we're in northeast L.A. County, right up against the foot of the Angeles National Forest.
Okay, so you've got a pretty mild climate. When I was a kid, and I'm going to be 63 on March 10th, when I was a kid, right after Thanksgiving, we'd have our first snowstorm most years, and we'd still have snow on the ground into March. And now the winters are usually quite mild. There was just one day I could go sled riding on about 2 inches of snow with my 7-year-old daughter Violet this winter. But the previous winter was similar to the ones we had in my childhood, with lots of snow. And I did a foraging tour in Connecticut the second week of March, and unlike Westchester, where I live, where the snow and ice was gone, there were still fairly large patches of ice that hadn't melted yet, and a lot of places where the ice had just melted. And on the ground were tons of red oak acorns. Those have huge amounts of tannin in them, which makes them quite a pain to process. I once tried boiling them repeatedly over a period of many days and couldn't get the bitter tannin out of them.
You shelled them, of course.
Excuse me? Shelled.
Yeah.
But these acorns, you took them out of the shell, bit into them. They were too bitter to eat, but not by much. They were sort of like the white oak acorns we have here, which require a minimum amount of leaching to get rid of the tannin. And with these red oak acorns, I didn't have to boil them at all. I just put them in a bowl of water after I shelled them and chopped them up, put them in a bowl of water, changed the water every morning and every night for 2 weeks, and presto, they were ready to turn into Korean acorn pudding. Don't boil them. The acorns have a gelling effect.
Yeah.
And it was quite remarkable finding acorns in early spring that had been obviously leached by freezing and melting under the ice, which also eliminated any of the insects that normally eat the acorns.
Yeah, that's interesting. Out here in California, I get acorns every year. And there are a lot of tricks and a lot of methods that people describe for the leaching. But one year, I actually did pick some out of a stream. And it had to have been many months after they fell. And there was some natural leaching that occurred.
The Americans did that. They put in a sack weighted with rocks and throw them in a stream.
Yeah. Well, acorns are big out here, at least among the Native Americans at powwows. The one guy that I know who eats it pretty regularly, he always tells his students, it's too much work. Just go to the Korean stores and buy the acorn flour, which is kind of funny. Now, just a thought. I've collected wild food books over the years from all countries of the world, from the Middle East, from China, from Japan, from, you know, different parts of Europe, Australia. And the Japanese are big on acorns, and I can't read it all because it's in Japanese, but I can see the pictures anyway and how they prepare.
I have a Japanese book that I can't read either that Japanese TV crew gave me. I would love to know what that says.
Well, so what, when I see it in the Korean stores, it looks like it's packed like tofu. And what are they actually doing with it? Do you know? I know they're eating it,
They're eating it. I've read about the procedure of making the pudding, and I think it's basically leaching them in cold water over a period of time. Maybe they puree them. I think if you look up if you look up Korean acorn pudding.
Okay, I should have done that.
Online, that yeah. should have the general ideas, and then we can improvise on there. I've read about live oaks that grow in your area that don't need leaching at all. Have you those?
I've never found acorns. The live oaks simply mean they're evergreen and they don't lose their leaves. They're not deciduous. But they all require leaching.
They do.
I mean, and they're all edible. Some require more leaching than others.
Right.
So there are some white oaks, and I have a friend, Paul Campbell, who goes into Mexico, and he tells me there's a little acorn there. I forgot the Latin name. It's Quercus something or other.
Right.
But it's a small acorn, but it doesn't require any leaching. And now, you've read the book My Side of the Mountain, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So remember the little
book? You eat what the birds eat and drop dead.
in the story, he was in upstate New York. Your neck of the woods.
Yep, my neck of the woods, right. And it was a good story, but very unrealistic.
Very unrealistic, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, they had him eating mushrooms, and they had him eating birds and deer from stray hunters, and they also had him eating acorns that did not require leaching from white oaks. Is that possible up there?
No, none of that is possible. I mean, if you eat what the birds, you could be eating the berries of the yew. Taxes, which are quite good, but if you don't spit out the seeds, you can die.
Yeah.
And there's only one person who can eat those and swallow the seeds with no harm. My ex-girlfriend, who ran off with another guy on Valentine's Day 6 years ago, she has no heart.
Okay, got to get that in, huh?
Yeah, the taxes is a has the cardiac glucosides that. Are certain death if you have even a small dosage. You know why taxus is so deadly?
I don't, Steve.
There's nothing certain but death and taxus.
Oh, wild food jokes. Okay. You know, people always want shortcuts. And they often say, look at what the animals eat. And for sure, you cannot do that, like you're saying.
Unless you're the same animal.
Unless you're the same animal, because we're not birds, we're not lizards, we're not deer, we're not cows. And, you know, some animals have greater digestive fluid, some animals can just tolerate more toxins. So I've told people, I don't know if you've seen the back of my wild food book, but I do talk about I think I list 14 entirely edible families. There are more, but even then, there are precautions. You know, you really need to learn plants individually, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, definitely. And the onion family is a really easy one.
Very easy, right.
And it's like an onion. So I did a tour in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. There's a very common species in the onion family here called field garlic, Allium vineale.
Okay.
And there is also a poisonous plant called Star of Bethlehem.
Okay.
And I told people on the tour, you need to watch out. The field garlic has an onion flavor and smell. You break it and smell it, you'll smell the onion. The leaves are cylindrical.
Right.
Star of Bethlehem has flat leaves with a stripe in the middle and absolutely no odor.
Right.
5 minutes later, someone was putting Star of Bethlehem in her bag.
Oh, boy.
I stopped her before she could eat any. But she still died. She died of embarrassment.
Another wild food joke. That's interesting. I've never had anybody die of any kind of poisoning. I have had a few people vomit. In one case, it was cattail shoot, and I think it might cattail shoots, but.
Maybe they were eating part of the outside, the fibrous part.
My thinking was that because I ate it too with no ill effect. My thinking was that the water could have been somewhat polluted, and that could have been an issue. But we also have the only way I can describe it. We have a yucca out here, and the young shoots are great raw, but it causes some kind of an irritation in the throat, and apparently some people vomit, so it's better cooked. I don't know what the chemistry is behind it. I'm sure you're familiar with elder out there in New York, right?
Yes.
So I used to have wild food parties. I still do sometimes, and we make all kind of things with elder. And I would store pressed elder and strained elder in my refrigerator and serve it as a drink. I like it, but some people cannot have it if it's not cooked. And I had two people vomiting pretty violently in my front yard after doing that.
Yeah, the elder is like the daylily. There are some people that can't tolerate it. Back to the cattail, there is one danger with a cattail. I always warn people about never pull out a cattail if there is an animal rights person watching.
If, oh God. Okay, you've got a million of them, right?
I'm an environmentalist, so I recycle them all.
It's early in the morning, Steve. I had to think about that one. My worst experience, I guess I would call it my worst. I was giving a lecture at a college, and there might have been 150 students there, and I'm passing all kind of stuff out. And by the time I'm three plants down, the plant that I talked about earlier is finally getting around the room.
Right.
I watched a guy about to put a poison hemlock leaf in his mouth.
Oh, how did he get that?
Well, I mean, I was foolish enough to pass him around. I don't take poisonous plants to lectures anymore, especially not like that.
Yeah, if I have them at a lecture, they stay at the table in the front, and there's a big drawing of a skull and crossbones on the plate.
That's smart. I like that.
That works. So the closest call I ever had, and this happened twice, independently, two reporters got seriously poisoned minutes before arriving at the meeting place for my tour. They had both eaten in New York delis.
Okay.
Food poisoning, and if it had been 5 minutes later, it would have been my fault.
That's funny. They would have blamed it on you.
Both recovered, fortunately.
Well, I like to show people poisonous things if we encounter them, only so they don't get the idea that somehow willy-nilly you just go out there and, if I'm only showing them edible things, they're saying, wow, this is great, go out and graze. But the reality is it's just not that way. You have to know what you're eating. You might make it look simple because you go out and you know everything. But you still have to caution the new student that, you have some cherry leaves you can't eat. You have this kind of tree, that kind of plant. You can't just eat everything without knowing what you're doing. So there is a learning curve to this, obviously.
Yeah, I work with a lot of kids, so one of the first things I do in introducing what I do with the plants is examine one of the plants, pretending one of the kids is a plant, and then pretend to take a bite out of the leaf, which is the kid's ear, and then drop to the ground dead. And the kids learn pretty quickly not to pick this stuff without supervision, or at least without trying it on the teacher first.
Yeah.
So none of the kids I've ever worked with in 30 years have gotten sick because they know not to go foraging on their own.
Right. It's not really that hard, when I was in high school, I started learning these things, and you learn one plant at a time. It seemed like very tedious at the beginning for me. I learned mustard. I learned miner's lettuce. I learned chickweed. And eventually you're eating and you're making meals. I learned lamb's quarter. You're making different things. You're trying different things. But it's just you have to have the desire to do it. And I think the part of for me was just it's a survival skill. I can go out and there's free food. I can just find it anywhere. That was what turned me on. It wasn't money and it wasn't nutrition.
Yeah, well, it's been a survival food for me. I'm in excellent health. I'm going to be 63. I swim a mile in 38 minutes, not record-breaking, but
that's good.
I'm decently fit, and just about everyone in my parents' and grandparents' generation were either dead before they reached my age or had... Had heart disease that was going to kill them a few years later. So I think the wild foods plus the exercise actually have helped me to survive literally quite a bit longer than my forebears. So I'm very grateful to the natural environment for giving me this opportunity. And I try to share as much as I can with other people, especially doing as much work as I can with kids. And kids are wonderful on the tours. They learn quickly. They laugh at my jokes.
Right.
Even
I laugh at the jokes.
Yeah, what have you been eating today?
I haven't been eating much. I did have some lamb's quarter this morning. Hey, talk to me about what you tell your students about the nutritional content. How do you explain?
Usually, what I see when it's been analyzed, the nutrients are usually quite a bit higher than what you get in the store, and I attribute this to the fact that the commercial foods are grown for appearance, for size, and for weight, so they have more water in them compared to actual food, mm-hmm. which is why you can put commercial carrots through a juicer and get quite a bit of juice. You put wild carrots through a juicer and you just get a few drops. There's more carrot and less water. And, of course, the carrots hold together much better if you pick them wild and cook with them than the commercial ones, which become mushy.
Right.
So
the wild ones are white, aren't they?
Yeah, they're white. And again, the field guides I started with gave you really no clue as to how to harvest them. I found them at their best in sunny fields near the seashore. The sand and the lack of competition from taller plants and from grass allows them to get quite large. And the other place I find them large is in pastures where where the manure has fertilized the soil. So those are the two habitats. When I first started, all the carrot roots I found were about as big as the graphite in a pencil.
That's pretty small.
Yeah. Then I just happened to dig some up at the seashore and discovered the people that didn't forage didn't really have any information on where to look for these things.
Huh.
So sandy, sunny fields without grass, you can get wonderful wild carrots there. And when you get tired of those, you can start looking for parsnips, at least on the East Coast. I don't know if you have wild parsnips where you are.
No, we don't. We have a lot of members of the parsley or carrot family. I think in all these years, I've found one, maybe two wild carrots out here. A lot of wild celery along the streams, but I only found wild carrot once. Now, I was introduced to wild carrot at my grandfather's farm in Ohio, and it's the white flower with the little purple dot, right?
Yes, they don't always have the purple dot.
Uh-huh. And what I remember...
And they look very much like poison hemlock.
That's right, close relative.
Except the poison hemlock root smells musty, sort of like a dead mouse, and the carrot is clearly like a carrot, smells like a carrot. Plus, the carrot, if you look at it closely, it obviously has fuzzy leaf stalks, and the poison hemlock does not.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a good sense of smell, anybody will recognize a carrot. It smells like a carrot.
Yeah, my 7-year-old daughter has no trouble telling that something is a carrot, and she knows about poison hemlock, which she's seen also. So there's no way she may get the wisdom of Socrates, but she won't go the way of Socrates.
I used to find carrots on my grandfather's farm. It was in pretty hard soil, but they were like almost as big as my thumb and maybe twice as long. But
probably from the natural fertilizer.
Could be, but they were not. They were very woody. All I really could eat was this outer skin, which I peeled off and ate. They were very woody there.
What time of year were you harvesting them?
Well, probably summertime. Maybe.
Oh yeah, you can't eat them in the summer.
That's it. It's too late.
All the food goes into the growing above ground parts.
Yeah, that's true.
You have to get them in the fall and early spring. And now that we're having mild winters, if rosette is still around during the winter, you can dig them up then too.
So you find that when you pull them early enough, you can take the whole wild carrot and put it in soup and stews and things, huh?
Oh yeah, yeah. They are wonderful. Carrot cakes and cookies are out of this world with the wild carrot. They're not as sweet as the commercial ones, but they have way more flavor, and when you cook them, a much better texture. They're harder to chew raw in a salad, so I tend to use commercial carrots more in salads and wild carrots for soups, cookies, and carrot cakes.
And all of our carrots are not natives, are they? They're all from Europe?
Yeah, that's right. And some of the European invasive plants really do so well here that they make great targets for harvesting, and then, of course, you're having zero environmental impact.
Well, that's right. That's one of the positive things about where I do foraging. There are areas and parks where they're trying to get rid of all of the introduced plants, and, you know, that means everything that we eat, lamb's quarter, chickweed, you know, most of these are European natives.
Right. Well, it's the ecologists are now pretty much coming to the conclusion it's a little foolish to go after all the invasive plants indiscriminately.
You'll never succeed.
Yeah, some are much more invasive than others. I mean, how much harm has chickweed ever done except to annoy gardeners who don't know to eat it? Whereas kudzu in the southeast,
well, it's different.
Really does pose problems.
Yeah, and actually, curly dock, I don't know how it grows there, but in the Central Valley of California, it's a perennial root, and it's very common and hard to get rid of. And I suspect, since they sell it in the health food trade as yellow dock, they could dig those roots up, and somebody could, and just be selling them.
Sure. We have some extensive stands of curly dock around here, but they're never really a major threat, and I certainly love eating that one. There is one caution with curly dock, though. Do not confuse curly dock with Modoc or Larry Doc. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have bitter doc Rumex obtusifolium out where you are?
We have Rumex crispus, and we have a few other Rumexes. I don't recognize that Latin name that you mentioned.
Okay. Well, the common names are broadleaf and bitter doc, and it is really bitter. And for decades, I told people, if you eat it, it won't kill you, but it tastes so bad it'll make you wish you were dead.
Right.
And then just recently I discovered that if you cook it, every bit of bitterness vanishes.
Uh-huh.
And it's as good as nettles or lamb's quarters.
Somebody once introduced me to his favorite, this was a guy from the South, his favorite wild food recipe. It's actually equal parts dock leaf, the curly dock, Rumex crispus, and onions and tomatoes. You just saute them in a pan, and the flavors complement each other so well, it's absolutely delicious. You might want to try it sometime.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, Steve, I get people occasionally who come, especially when times are hard economically, and they ask me, how many classes of yours do I need to take before I don't need to go to the supermarket? Have you ever gotten queries like that?
Not really. I mean, there are some people who are taking all the primitive skills classes that they can, but people aren't trying to live exclusively off wild foods.
I mean, I never have, and frankly, I told the guy, if that's the only reason you're doing it, you might as well just get more work and buy your food, because it's going to... I don't think I ever... That was never a goal of mine, but I have gone out for periods of time without food, you know, for a week or two. But it was maybe 10 years when I was into it before I could do that successfully and not be hungry at all.
Yeah, I've personally never had a penchant for the whole survivalist thing. I'm more a science geek and a mad scientist in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So I've just never been drawn to that personally, but I can certainly see people enjoying that, and a lot of people who are survivalists come on my tours, and now there's a whole population of preppers that are getting into this.
I get
civilization as we know it ends. But, again, I think I've survived immediately from the health benefits of the wild foods, where so many people around us are having problems with obesity and diabetes and heart disease. That's partially brought on by the bad food environment that our culture has produced.
This is true. I'm frankly not as interested in the end of the world as I am about improving my day-to-day life. That's why I do it.
Yeah, well, certainly if you enjoy good food and health, it's certainly going to improve your day-to-day life.
Yeah, but I do get, especially, not so much anymore, but I used to get a lot of queries. We go on these walks, we're in the wild, we're collecting enough for a meal, just while we're out for the day, and I pull out my salad dressing. And then somebody will say, well, isn't that cheating? And I say, what do you mean cheating? Cheating according to whose rules? So my whole thing has always been to make the use of wild plants just normal. Just introduce it and incorporate it into your daily life. It's not odd. It's not different. It's just another source of food.
Yeah, we're basically doing the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a good source of food. I bring recipes. We have a lunch break on the tour. People bring a box lunch, and I'll pass out wild ice cream, vegan wild ice creams from a thermos bottle, or curried sunflower seeds, or sourdough rye bread made with wild yeast with some wild onions and common spice bush berries chopped up that's an eastern species. You probably don't have it.
No, we don't. That sounds really good, though.
It's a bush as a berry that tastes sort of like allspice.
Yeah, I've heard of it, and I might have seen it when I lived in Ohio, but I don't see it out here.
It's definitely in Ohio.
Yeah.
Hunters would skewer venison with the spice bush to give it more flavor.
Really, the wood would impart a flavor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now tell me about your wild yeast. Where does that come from?
That comes from the air.
So how do you make it?
Okay, you go to a health food store and buy wheat berries, maybe a cup of wheat.
Okay.
And soak them overnight to germinate them. And then put them in a mesh bag or an old stocking or something for about 3 or 4 days. Hang it over the sink. Moisten it every morning and every night. In about 3 days, the yeast berries will have shoots that are about as long as the berries.
Okay.
And these aren't like berries like blackberries. They're basically the seed.
It's a dry grain, yeah.
Yeah, it's the seed of the wheat. For some reason, they're confusingly called berries. So when that happens, when the sprout is as long as the wheat grain, maybe that's a better term for it, you put that into a blender with water.
Okay.
And blend it very briefly on low speed just to crack the wheat berries.
Okay.
And then cover one part wheat berries with 4 parts water. Put that in a bowl. Put a towel on top of it to keep dust from going in. And stir that every morning and every night for maybe 4 or 5 days. And eventually, wild yeast from the air will colonize the wheat berries, and it will start to bubble and become sour.
Huh.
Then you have the world's best sourdough starter.
Wow.
What I do with that is I strain out and discard the wheat berries, and I mix this liquid with enough freshly ground rye flour to make a medium batter. And I let that ferment for several days until the batter starts to bubble. Then you can use that sourdough starter, which you replenish with more water and more rye flour. You can use that for making incredible tangy-tasting bread, pancakes, any kind of baked good you could possibly imagine. You feed the starter with more rye flour and more water every few days. And, of course, if you use it for baking, leave a little and replenish it with more rye flour and water. And it lasts quite a long time in the refrigerator. It's going to be more than a week or two, and you're not using it, you can freeze it.
Now, is this an old technique that's like died out somewhat? I've never heard of this.
It's an old new technique.
An old new technique.
The sourdoughs in the gold rush in Alaska did something similar with white flour, which is a lot harder to get the yeast going than with the wheat berries.
I see. Do you make
this is a new kind of technique that varies on an old one from the Alaska Gold Rush.
I see. Do you have this in your book?
Yeah, that's in my cookbook, and it's in my app. My app, Wild Edibles, has at least one recipe for every plant, and there are about 165 plants, basically just about everything good that grows in this part of the world that you can use for food. Again, half of those or very close relatives grow where you are.
I would guess more than half would be applicable to the West Coast.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many mustards there that if you see miner's lettuce in flower, you'll recognize it as the mustard, even though I've never gotten a photo or did a painting of miner's lettuce. I only really tasted it once when someone sent it to me. At least half the plants grow where you are, and I have all my cooking experiments. One of my latest ones, I love mushrooms, so I made chocolate truffles, and I don't use animal products, so no milk chocolate. I also don't use sugar. What I did with the truffles.
Do you use honey?
No, I'm a vegan, and honey is a concentrated carbohydrate. It acts in the body fairly with a high glycemic load, fairly similar to sugar. I guess the main thing is that it's sweeter than sugar, so you don't need as much.
Why would you not eat honey if you're a vegan?
It's an animal product.
It's not. The bees, isn't it just, it's simply the dehydrated nectar from the flowers.
Yeah, but you're still disrupting the bees.
Okay. So do you have, do you do things like sauerkrauts and taking wild foods and do that too?
Yeah. I use a fairly bitter mustard called Wintercress.
Yeah, I know it.
The most unfavored of all the wild foods I show people on my tours.
Because it's bitter.
Yeah, because it's bitter. And I make a kimchi where I pickle it with caraway seeds and salt. You can, if you don't like too much salt, you can rinse off the salt at the table. And that comes out really well. Mm. But back with the chocolate truffles,
yeah.
One of my latest recipes, you grind up raw dates with almonds in a food processor. Add some lecithin granules, which makes it sort of rich-tasting, like egg yolks. Lecithin that gives eggs their creaminess, color, and flavor. A tiny amount of almond oil, and the scrapings of a vanilla bean, which is much more flavorful than vanilla extract. The sweetener I use is liquid stevia from a Central American herb that's been used for hundreds of years as a sweetener. And a little bit of salt, and the flavorings are butterscotch extract and Kentucky coffee tree seeds. I don't know if you have that on the West Coast.
We don't, but I know what it is.
Yeah, it's a legume that has seeds that taste like coffee after you roast.
Yeah.
And I put in melted dark chocolate without dairy and without sweetener and unsweetened cocoa, and the stevia is enough to make these things and the dates to make it really sweet. And I grind that all together, roll it into balls, and then you can roll the balls in either cocoa powder or carob powder, and you have wonderful chocolate truffles without all the sugar that's in commercial chocolate. And without the butter fat that you get with the milk chocolate.
It actually sounds really good. Is that recipe on your website, or is it just in the book?
That's in my Wild Edibles app under Kentucky Coffee Tree. And if you don't have the Kentucky Coffee Tree, you can use coffee extract.
Okay, cool. We're just about out of time, Steve. I appreciate you spending the time. Tell us once again your website so people can contact you and learn about your books. I presume your books are all available from you online?
Yes, and I'd appreciate it if people get the book signed from my website so that Amazon doesn't get all but a few pennies of the money. So the website is wildmansteveBrill.com, and the app is Wild Edibles. You can download it from the iTunes Store or the Android Marketplace. I have another book coming out in the spring, and anyone who's anywhere near the greater New York area, come on my tours, and you can friend me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter.
And remember, guys, buy your book from Steve, and he gets the money, and you're supporting his work rather than Amazon. Hey, thanks so much, Steve.
Sure, it's been a pleasure. Send me a link when it's ready.